Welcome to the Michael Jackson Case for Innocence podcast. My name is Cheryl, and this is my daughter.
Hi, I'm June. My mom and I are working together in this podcast to present the evidence for Michael Jackson's innocence of the sex abuse claims against him. Today we'll be presenting part one of the Chandler allegations. You can find all our source material for this episode on our website, MichaelJacksonCaseForInnocence.com.
Our series on the Chandlers will take us four episodes plus a summary to cover. These first episodes will lay the groundwork for introducing the people and events you'll need to know for the later cases. The innocence argument says the Chandler case created the blueprint for all the accusations that followed, so you can't evaluate Jackson's guilt or innocence without a close look at these first allegations.
This podcast is the uncondensed version of the abuse allegations against Michael Jackson. If you prefer a more concise summary with less detail, you can visit our website for recommendations. These first allegations against Michael Jackson came in 1993. That's 11 years after Thriller was released in 1982. Michael went on the Bad Tour for 16 months in the late 80s and went on the Dangerous Tour in the early 90s to raise money for charity. His Super Bowl performance was in January 1993, and his Oprah Winfrey interview was in February of 93. The Chandler allegations became public while Michael was on the second leg of the Dangerous Tour, in August 1993.
Although you'll find many sources on our website for these episodes on the Chandlers, there are four references that you'll hear us cite most often, so we're going to introduce these sources before we begin. Number 1. The accuser's father is Evan Chandler, and he recounts his version of events to his brother Ray Chandler in their book All That Glitters. We'll refer to All That Glitters as either Evan's book or Ray Chandler's book.
Number 2. The testimony of the accuser's mother, June Chandler, from Jackson's criminal trial in 2005.
Number 3. A well-known and well-sourced GQ article by journalist Mary Fisher entitled, Was Michael Jackson Framed? When we reference this work, we'll call it Mary Fisher's article. And finally,
Number 4. The psychiatrist's interview with the accuser, Jordan Chandler, from October 1993.
You'll be hearing a new voice in this episode.
Hi, I'm Paul.
Paul Stefano is a voice actor who will be helping us present the Chandler series. My daughter will also be narrating, and I want to take a moment to comment on my decision to use her voice. In the previous introductory episode, you mostly heard June when she was younger, 12 and 13. At that age, I didn't want to include her voice in these episodes about sex abuse allegations. But as I was doing the re-recordings near the release of the podcast, June was nearing 15, and she wanted to help carry the weight of presenting the evidence. She's matured in these years and has shown herself to be thoughtful and serious when approaching the evidence in these cases. It made sense to include her voice to enhance the authenticity and listenability of the podcast. So you'll hear June's voice throughout, along with myself and the voice actor, although her parts avoid especially sensitive topics. We'll now begin our story of the Chandler allegations, with Michael Jackson meeting the Chandler family, using the accounts of all four sources just listed. In May of 1992, Michael Jackson's car breaks down in Beverly Hills. The wife of a car rental agent spots Jackson and calls her husband to bring him to the rental office. The owner of the agency, Dave Schwartz, calls his wife June Chandler and tells her to bring over her son, who's a Michael Jackson fan. June and her first husband, Evan Chandler, divorced when their son Jordan was around 5, and June was awarded full custody. She remarried Dave Schwartz, and they have a daughter together. Evan Chandler also remarried, and they have another boy and girl. At the car rental agency, June Chandler explains to Michael Jackson how they've been trying to meet him for a long time and had written many letters to him. According to Jordan's later interview, his stepfather Dave Schwartz tells Jackson that he'll rent a car for free if Jackson agrees to call Jordan. From June Chandler's testimony, Jackson first calls Jordan about 2 months after they meet, and then he calls about once a month between August 92 and January 93, while Jackson's overseas on the Dangerous Tour. She says they talk about topics like video games, and she's always present for the phone calls.
Calling friends on the phone was a regular habit of Jackson's, especially when stuck in his hotel room on tour. In a later episode, you'll hear stories about Jackson's legendary long phone calls with many adult friends and collaborators. You'll also hear how Michael Jackson befriended and got close to many families all over the world. Except for the four accusers covered in this podcast, these families all defend his innocence. Jackson often spoke about how he was indebted to his fans for his success. From his perspective, he wanted to give back and share this success by connecting with fans like the Chandler family and many others, and opening up his world to them. But regardless of the motive, talking once a month to the Chandlers is not unusual compared to how often Jackson reportedly called others.
In February 1993, 9 months after meeting Jackson, June Chandler says that she, her daughter, and Jordan, who's 13, visit Neverland for the first time for a two-night stay in a guest house. She says they enjoy rides, video games, and a trip to Toys R Us. June confirms in her testimony that she and Dave Schwartz were separated since before they met Jackson. And according to Schwartz's own words from a recorded conversation, he takes the blame for this separation because of his neglect. He says he's a workaholic. Here's a quote from Evan Chandler's book.
It was no secret that June and Dave were not a match made in heaven. She had threatened divorce before. He was a workaholic, rarely at home, and lived away from the family for months at a time.
A month later, in early March 93, June Chandler says that she, Jordan, and her daughter have their second visit with Jackson at the ranch. They're taken to Neverland by Jackson's driver, and Brett Barnes is also in the car, who's around the same age as Jordan. Barnes and his family went on part of the Dangerous Tour the year before, and they've consistently supported Jackson's innocence.
That weekend, according to June, Jordan asks if he can sleep in Jackson's bedroom suite because all the other kids are there. The Casio family is also visiting Neverland at this time. So we know that the Chandlers aren't alone on this visit to Neverland. There are other kids there, too.
On March 16th, Jackson has scalp surgery to remove the bald spot on top of his head that resulted from his burn back in 1984. The hairpiece Jackson wore to cover the bald spot interfered with his dance performances, so he planned surgery in between legs of the Dangerous Tour. This is explained by Jackson's surgeon and others in testimony for the AEG negligence lawsuit that went to trial in 2013.
Dr. Sasaki says there's a lot of pain after this procedure, and Jackson was suffering from additional pain because the surgery caused a neuroma to develop on top of his head. A neuroma is a growth of hypersensitive nerve tissue. Jackson was experiencing constant pain and migraine headaches in the months after the procedure.
In an interview with Larry King, Jackson's dermatologist, Dr. Klein, says that he was against the surgery because of Jackson's cutaneous lupus, a degenerative skin disease which makes scarring worse and wound healing harder. He said every time they do scalp revisions, the bald spot would actually keep enlarging because of the effects of his lupus. Dr. Klein also said he was against the surgery because the skin stretching procedure was so painful and because Jackson had to wear a big hat all the time in order to cover, yet provide enough air, around the healing wound.
This scalp surgery and neuroma are important to the later allegations that abuse occurred during this time of wound healing. We'll come back to this subject once the allegations are detailed in a later episode. So far, we only have the two Chandler visits to Neverland, one in February and one in March. June says their third contact with Jackson might have been their trip to Las Vegas at the end of March for a couple nights stay in a hotel suite. So this would be soon after Jackson's scalp surgery. June and her daughter stay in one room, and Jackson and Jordan stay in another. Between mid-April until the end of May, according to June's testimony, Jackson stays over at her house at her invitation approximately 30 times. These visits are confirmed by the 1994 testimony of Jackson's driver, Gary Hearn. But Hearn also testified that he saw nothing inappropriate between Jackson and Jordan, that they seem like a family that likes spending time together. I'm going to take a little time out here on the issue of where Jackson slept in the Chandler home, because there's a lack of clarity by the Chandler family that I found suspicious. Jordan's father, Evan, in his book, says Jackson sleeps in Jordan's room, in the same double bed. But neither June nor Jordan specifically confirm this.
In June Chandler's testimony against Michael Jackson in 2005, she says he stayed in Jordan's room, but oddly, she never says where in his room. She says she never saw anything suspicious, and she was never worried. If prosecutor Tom Snedden knew that Jackson slept in the same bed as Jordan, he would surely have directly asked June Chandler on the stand, because it would have been very helpful to his case, but he never asked that question.
Although this idea of Jackson staying in Jordan's room sounded suspicious to me, especially early in my research, I tried to keep some things in mind. First of all, we never get to hear Jackson's side of the story, because he was forbidden by the terms of the later settlement. The only accounts we have about these visits were from those who profited from the $1 million settlement, Evan, June, and Jordan. In Evan's own book, he describes how he and his ex-wife were both very money-focused, wanting the best of everything and wanting to move up, in terms of a bigger house and more expensive cars. It's important to consider their financial gain when evaluating their stories.
There's also the many stories by friends about Jackson preferring to sleep on the floor. According to Tara Borelli's biography, Jackson had no bed in his room at Havenhurst as an adult, but just slept on the floor by the fireplace.
Freddie Mercury was very surprised that Jackson didn't have a bed when he saw his room at Havenhurst. Mercury's assistant, Peter Freestone, says in an interview that Jackson explained to them that he feels better when he sleeps closer to the earth.
Michael's brother Jermaine, in his book You Are Not Alone, mentions how Jackson liked to sleep on the floor.
Jackson made Blanca Francia testified that he always slept on the floor in sleeping bags in one of his L.A. condos.
His nephews have also spoken about their uncle Michael sleeping on the floor when he was a guest in their home.
So Jackson may have just slept on the floor in Jordan's room or elsewhere in the Chandler home, which would help explain why June and Jordan seemed to avoid the subject.
June Chandler was separated from Dave Schwartz at this time, and he was not in the home. But we do know from June's testimony that she had a live-in maid who was there when Jackson was visiting in that April to May timeframe.
It puzzles me that we have no mention about what June's live-in maid has to say. Someone who doesn't have the same conflict of interest as the family, and someone who would know where Jackson slept during his stay. The police knew about the maid back in 1993, so certainly interviewed her, but she was never brought forward as a witness. I found it odd that Evan's book, which abounds in details that further his narrative, completely leaves out what this housekeeper might have observed. If she'd said anything that would have helped the Chandler's accusations, such as seeing that Jackson slept in Jordan's bed, I'm certain that she would be in Evan's book, and that D.A. Tom Snedden would have called her as a witness in Jackson's trial. And finally, on this issue of sleeping arrangements, I wanted to take into account the families who've shared their innocent stories about hosting Jackson in their homes.
Families such as the Cassios, the Schleiders, the Steins, and Emmanuel Lewis have spoken about Jackson's friendship with them. Unlike the Chandlers, they did have extra bedrooms, and that's where Jackson stayed when he visited them. However, Jackson never asked to stay in the kids' rooms, and there was no escalation of trying to get closer to the kids in pushing away the parents. They all are consistent in their accounts that Jackson befriended the whole family and brought the family closer together on his visits.
Emmanuel Lewis explains in interviews how after Jackson's burn in 84, he stayed at the Lewis home at their invitation as a place to recover for months after his painful scalp surgeries. This stay at the Chandlers was also after Jackson's scalp surgery, and it's possibly why June Chandler invited him to stay over during this specific time period.
These remarks aren't meant to suggest that Jackson never actually shared a bed with kids. And we'll get into the experiences of other children at Neverland in later episodes. I wanted to highlight these visits and the sleeping arrangements because they were what I got stuck on when I first looked into the allegations. All the other cases against Jackson fell apart quicker because of clear and overwhelming evidence. But the Chandler case took me longer to evaluate, specifically because of my questions about these overnights. And I was frustrated that there wasn't more clarity on exactly where Jackson slept in their house. The evasiveness by June, Jordan, and Prosecutor Snedden around this specific issue proved to be a pattern throughout the case against Jackson. I ask that you reserve judgment about these visits until we cover more evidence, especially the personal side of Michael Jackson in season two.
So far, the Chandlers have had a few visits to Neverland and a couple of days in Las Vegas with Jackson. June Chandler testifies that a few weeks later in April, they all travel for a few days to Walt Disney World.
On May 5th, Jackson attends a charity event in Georgia with Lisa Marie Presley, sponsored by Jimmy Carter. According to Lisa Marie, she and Michael are speaking regularly and getting closer during this time period, after having met in 1992.
On May 12th, the Chandlers appear with Jackson at the World Music Awards in Monaco. They also visit Euro Disney in Paris, for a trip total of about 6 days. As expected because of the recent surgery, Jackson is wearing a hat in all the pictures from the World Music Awards.
On May 20th, Jackson first meets Jordan's biological father, Evan Chandler, who is a dentist. According to June's testimony, Evan was busy writing screenplays when he wasn't seeing patients and didn't spend much time with Jordan until Michael Jackson came into their lives. The year before, in 1992, Evan co-wrote a screenplay for the Mel Brooks movie Robin Hood, Men in Tights. Ray Chandler writes about his brother Evan's extreme commitment to writing screenplays during his free time, but with no further success.
Jackson spends the weekend of May 22nd at Evan's house, with his second wife, their son and daughter, and Jordan. It's on this weekend visit that there are conflicting accounts.
Evan, in his book, says that Jackson tells him he wants to live with Jordan and offers to pay for the renovations needed to make that happen. Mary Fisher's article, however, claims the opposite, that it's Evan who suggests that Jackson should move in with them and pay for an addition to the house.
One of Mary Fisher's sources is Jackson's lawyer at the time, Burt Fields, so it's likely that through him we're getting Jackson's version of this conversation. There's also confirmation by June in her later testimony that it was Evan who wanted Jackson to finance a wing on his house. We'll return to this dispute later, but either an offer by Jackson or a request by Evan is made over this weekend visit.
Right after this weekend on May 25th, a National Enquirer story is published titled Michael Jackson's Secret Family. Evan and Ray Chandler's book claims that this was the sister of June's closest friend who sold the story about Michael's friendship with the Chandlers.
It's this tabloid article that journalist Victor Gutierrez will later say reawakens his interest in researching Jackson and boys, and he wants to track down the Chandlers. In his own words, Gutierrez is obsessed with this topic, and I found him to be one of the shadiest characters in this case. We'll get back to Victor Gutierrez in the next episode, because he appears to make contact with Evan Chandler at some point after this Enquirer article is published.
Evan says it's the following weekend, May 28th, that he becomes suspicious about Jackson, who's visiting for a couple days that weekend as well. The weekend before, he describes enjoying his time with Jackson and thought he was a great influence on Jordan, especially helping with homework. Now, 1 week later, Evan says he's having his suspicions about the relationship between Jackson and his son and wants to question them about it.
But even with these supposed suspicions, Evan puts Jackson in a trundle bed next to Jordan, whose half-brother is on the top bunk. I have a hard time getting over that scene. Evan has suspicions that Jackson might have a physical relationship with his son, and then he puts his son right next to the suspected perpetrator. The following morning, Evan says he asks Jordan completely out of the blue, "Hey, Jordy, are you and Michael doing it?" "That's disgusting." He says Jordy reacted genuinely. "I'm not into that." Evan says in his book that Jordy's repulsion brought him great relief. So apparently Jordan's instinctive response to an out-of-the-blue question is repulsion, and he has no hesitation or fear expressed in his denial.
Evan says Jackson complains about a strong headache that same morning. From a scalp surgery a couple months earlier, he is now suffering from the extreme sensitivity and pain of a neuroma, a protruding nerve bundle. Evan says he gives him aspirin and Tylenol, but they don't work, so he calls his dental anesthesiologist, who comes over to the house with Toradol, a prescription anti-inflammatory medicine. According to his own account, Evan injects 30 milligrams of it into Jackson's gluteal muscles, but because Jackson is still in pain, he administers another 30 milligrams, which he says is a normal dose, and according to the drug information website NPR, it is a normal dose. Evan says Jackson displays drunk-like symptoms from the injection, acting weird, babbling incoherently, and slurring his speech. Once Jackson is in a somewhat coherent, but still uninhibited condition, Evans says in his book that he decides to take advantage of the situation to ask him questions about his sexuality, such as whether he is gay. Jackson answers that he's not.
This scene, as Evan himself described in his book, is troubling to me. Here's a dentist providing injectable painkillers to someone not his patient for a non-dental condition. Dentists are only licensed to administer drugs for dental purposes. And I find it unlikely that someone who received a normal dose of Toradol would be incoherent and babbling. The common side effects for Toradol primarily act on the gastrointestinal system, such as heartburn, diarrhea, and gas. Under rare side effects, and there are about 100 listed, one is hallucinations. So it's possible that Jackson had an extremely rare reaction to a normal dose of an anti-inflammatory medicine. But it would be very convenient that an unlikely reaction gives Evan a surprise opportunity to test Jackson, just at the time he says he wanted to anyway. It's clearly unethical, not only to administer this drug as a dentist, especially without consulting Jackson's doctor, but to take advantage of Jackson in a vulnerable state. It possibly didn't even happen, and it's just a tale for enhancing the drama in his book. I think it's more likely that he administered a stronger drug such as Demerol, which more commonly causes effects like euphoria and mental clouding, that Evan clearly wants to take advantage of. If this story is true, whether it was Toradol or Demerol, it's one of the many examples I read of how Jackson was too trusting and put himself in vulnerable positions. This pattern of trusting when he shouldn't repeats itself again and again across many different aspects of his life.
Mary Fisher shares the findings of her investigation into the backgrounds of Chandler and his anesthesiologist. She reports that Evan's dental anesthesiologist was being investigated by the Drug Enforcement Agency for making house calls to administer drugs for non-dental purposes. They found the drugs he used were mostly morphine and Demerol.
Fisher's article gives examples of these non-dental-related house calls, including quoting by name a former patient, who says Evan's anesthesiologist came to her house to administer Demerol after an appendectomy.
Actress Carrie Fisher was a patient of Evan's during this time period. In her book, Shockaholic, Carrie Fisher describes both Evan Chandler and his anesthesiologist as Hollywood doctors who abuse their powers when it comes to giving patients drugs. She writes,
I had this dentist at the time, a Dr. Evan Chandler, who was a very strange character. He was what would be referred to as the dentist to the stars, and as one of the people who would have unnecessary dental work just for the morphine, this man was one of those people who could arrange such a welcome service. He referred his patients to a mobile anesthesiologist, who would come into the office to put you out for the dental work. And as if that wasn't glorious enough, he could also be easily and financially persuaded to come to your house to administer the morphine for your subsequent luxury pain relief.
So if you take all of it together, the DEA investigation, the interviews with former patients, Carrie Fisher's account, and Evan's own account of giving Jackson a painkiller injection, you get a picture of Evan Chandler as willing to overstep the ethical boundaries of his profession.
Evan says that Jackson didn't feel well and stayed in bed all day after the injection he gave him. And despite saying in his book that he was suspicious of Jackson molesting Jordan, Evan, for a second night, puts him in the bedroom with his two sons.
Evan's story is that he checked on Jackson three times that night, apparently trying to catch him in the act. The third time he checked, he says Jordan had gotten into Jackson's bed and they were sleeping in a spooning position, quote, with Michael's arm wrapped tightly around the boy, his hand resting on the boy's crotch on the outside of the covers. Ever so gently, Evan picked up Michael's arm and moved it to the side, then slowly pulled back the covers. Thank God, they were both fully clothed, unquote. I find it convenient to Evan's story that neither Jordan nor Jackson nor his other son awoke when Evan opened the door, came over to their bed, and lifted Jackson's arm in the covers. And although just the day before, Evan said he was determined to question Jordan and Jackson about their relationship. After supposedly seeing the spooning, Evan didn't question either of them the next morning. Evan also doesn't say anything to Jordan's mom. He does nothing except say in his book that this troubled him. I've been unable to imagine a workable narrative for this scene. If Evan had the expected parental reaction, he would have stopped the contact immediately and not allowed Jackson near his son again. Evan wasn't wowed by his celebrity. He says he was already suspicious. So if Evan didn't protect his child in this strange scene, I wondered about other possible responses. Maybe he didn't stop them because he wanted to wait and see if it progressed to something more. But Evan says after supposedly seeing them spooning, with Jackson's hand over his son's crotch, he does not go back and check again. He himself goes to bed. That's very hard to imagine, just going back to bed after supposedly seeing this. Does he think this behavior is actually acceptable, and that's why he didn't stop it? Ray and Evan's book described Jackson's behavior as child abuse, so it doesn't make sense that Evan thinks it's acceptable. Is Evan already thinking that he can use this relationship to extort money from Jackson, and that's why he didn't say anything? Then why didn't he try and take a picture or get another witness, like his wife or other son, sleeping in the very same room? I can't make this scene logically work. Evan says after that weekend, he tries to convince his ex-wife June to end the relationship with Jackson. But he never mentions what he supposedly saw in Jackson's bed. By his own account, he's desperately trying to convince June to end the relationship. But he keeps the most convincing argument of what he saw to himself. This is very odd, and leaves me with the impression that the bed scene is concocted from Evan's imagination, as a dramatic embellishment to his story once he starts talking to the media and writing his book with his brother.
Evan says June told him he was being ridiculous and that he was just jealous. Here's what the Chandler's book says about Evan's suspicions at this point.
Evan couldn't help but wonder if all his concerns about Michael were nothing more than manifestations of paranoia.
But if Evan actually saw them together, and if he actually lifted up Jackson's arm to move it, it doesn't make sense that Evan would be questioning his suspicions as paranoia. And reinforces my suspicions that Evan didn't see anything at all. Adding to the weakness of Evan's account, it's actually Jackson who cuts off contact with Evan. And this severing of contact is important to making sense of what went down between Evan and Jackson. We're going to share two accounts from Jackson's friends regarding what happened between Evan and Michael Jackson.
The Cassio family was very close with Michael Jackson since the 80s, and they were lifelong friends. Michael would stay in their home near New York City in a guest room for many visits over many years, and they were frequent visitors at Neverland. One of the sons, Frank Cassio, is the same age as Jordan Chandler. Frank hung out with Jordan at Neverland, which is confirmed in June Chandler's testimony. In his book, My Friend Michael, Frank Cassio describes talking with Michael about Evan Chandler.
When I was older, Michael would tell me that Jordy's father had wanted Michael to invest in a film he wanted to make. Michael initially liked the idea, but his advisors were against it. They dismissed Jordy's father rather thoughtlessly, and Michael, not one for confrontation, blew him off too. Michael thought that this, more than anything else, had set Evan Chandler off.
Michael Jackson was known to be wary about people using him for self-promotion or money, and when he sensed it, he often just cut a person off. From many accounts, Jackson just didn't confront people, and often instead stopped talking to them. And this caused a lot of anger in cases that I read about, in both business and personal relationships. And later stories will illustrate this.
In a 2010 interview for the website Reflections on the Dance, painter David Nordahl shares his story about this time period in 1993, when Jackson was home between legs of the Dangerous Tour. Nordahl was working on sketches for Jackson's new film company that Sony was funding with $40 million. Nordahl says since getting co-writing credit for Men in Tights, Evan Chandler considered himself a screenwriter and assumed he could get a partnership in Jackson's company. Nordahl says that's where the later figure of $20 million would come from. Evan wanted half the Sony money.
This request by Evan is also mentioned in an LA Times article dated August 28, 1993.
Film industry sources have said that the boy's father sought a $20 million movie production and financing deal with Jackson.
Even the Chandler's book states that Evan discusses a movie deal with Jackson, but says that it was Jordan who asked Michael to give Evan a job in his film company.
The fact that it's Jackson who cuts off contact, as stated by Evan himself, lends support to the Cassio and Mary Fisher version of events, in which Evan asks Jackson about funding renovations to his house and asks about a movie deal. If Jackson really wants to be close to Jordan, Evan is offering easy access if Jackson funds the renovations. And giving Evan a job in the movie production company would be a smart move if Jackson is looking to keep any molestation from coming to light, but he declines both.
For the next week and a half, Evan says he is growing anger that Jackson and his son aren't talking to him. Jordan is mad at his dad for his accusatory reaction and doesn't want to talk to him. Evan tries to convince June to break off the relationship, but not really offering any reasons beyond that Jackson was breaking up the family, a family that Evan apparently didn't pay much attention to until Jackson was in the picture.
In Evan's own book, he admits to jealousy of Jackson. Evan hopes that once Jackson goes on tour in August 1993, it will end. However, Jackson invites June and the children to go with him on tour.
Evan expresses his jealousy to his ex-wife June and her husband Dave. Michael Freeman, June Chandler's lawyer, would later say that Evan felt left out. This is a theme that I've seen in all four accusations. In each case, the accuser or his parents could see how others around Jackson got the benefits of his wealth and fame, and they felt entitled to have their own share. On June 9th, Jordan and Evan are finally together for a family event. The following is Evan's account of the exchange he had with Jordan at this gathering.
What if I wanted you to stay home and not go on tour?
I'd go anyway. You'd have to give a good reason why not.
Because you guys lied to me, and you know how much I hate liars. You're not going on tour. Now, let's go. I'm taking you home.
And by lying, he means Jordan and Jackson are lying about the nature of their relationship. Ray Chandler in his book said lying angered Evan like nothing else. Evan continues his accusations to Jordan at this family event, saying,
I know what's going on.
But when Jordan's mom sees Evan later that day, he doesn't mention any concerns or suspicions that he knows what's going on. He just asks if she thinks Jordan is gay. And when June says, who cares if he is, Evan flies off the handle and orders her out of his house. Evan says June calls him later and complains.
You're a terrible father. You're just using Jordan for his writing talents.
She accuses him of not following through on his promise to give Jordy $5,000 for his work on the Men in Tights screenplay. The exchanges that Evan relays in his book between him and his ex-wife are the most authentic sounding of his entire account, possibly because he knew his ex-wife could contradict the stories that involved her.
Several days later on June 13th, Evan talks to his dental patient, lawyer Barry Rothman, about the situation with Jackson. Evan says in exchange for his dental treatment, Rothman offers to help him end the relationship by either filing a restraining order against Jackson or a custody lawsuit against June.
In Mary Fisher's article, she states that her research on Barry Rothman's background reveals a pattern of manipulation and deceit. She writes that as part of a lawsuit against Rothman, a report filed in L.A. Superior Court included a list of more than 30 creditors and judgment holders who were after him, so Rothman either couldn't or wouldn't pay his bills.
Fisher details the court documents that show Rothman created a network of foreign bank accounts and shell companies to conceal his assets. She also discovered that disciplinary actions for three incidents were taken against Rothman by the California State Bar.
In one of these conflict of interest incidents, which is described in detail in Fisher's article, Rothman was suspended in 1992. This suspension was stayed and he was placed on probation instead. He was just coming off this probation when he began his discussions with Evan Chandler.
There are more details about Rothman's history in Fisher's article.
I found this background information about Chandler's lawyer important to keep in mind, not only because it reveals Rothman's financial troubles, but also because of past history of fraud and a disregard for the ethics of his profession increases the likelihood of future fraudulent and dishonest behavior. On June 20th, Jordan refuses to talk to Evan on Father's Day. Evan says he repeatedly yells at June, saying things like,
Let me tell you something, June. He better call me, and it better be soon, or you're all going to be sorry. You know me. I've had enough.
But no one calls him back.
On July 7th, Evan's lawyer, Barry Rothman, files papers to alter the custody agreement between Evan and June. Mary Fisher's article notes that in order for his plan to move forward, Evan needs to get custody of Jordan. He leaves a threatening message on June's answering machine, warning her that there is nothing that could be more important for June, Jackson, and Jordan than to meet with Evan 2 days later on July 9th.
June and her husband Dave are suspicious of Evan's actions, so Dave records 3 phone conversations with Evan. We're going to present some of the dialogue from these taped conversations between Evan and Jordan's stepfather, Dave. Evan acknowledges in his book that it is him in this recording. You can find full transcripts of these recordings through links on our website. The reason Evan is sharing his thoughts with Dave, as he says in his book, is that he thinks he can make him an ally against June and Jackson. At the beginning of this recording, Evan tells Dave that he's been advised by his lawyer to be careful with what he says and to be careful with what he reveals about his plan. So we learn that this is not a completely candid conversation. Regarding his lawyer, Barry Rothman, Evan says to Dave,
"I picked the nastiest son of a I could find, and all he wants to do is get this out in the public as fast as he can, as big as he can, and humiliate as many people as he can. It could be a massacre if I don't get what I want. He is nasty, he is mean, he is very smart, and he's hungry for the publicity. This guy's just going to destroy everybody in sight in any devious, nasty, cruel way that he can do it, and I've given him full authority to do it."
So why does Evan want to destroy and humiliate Jackson? At this point, Jordan is consistently denying any abuse. And when Dave directly asks Evan if he thinks Jordan is having sexual contact with Jackson, Evan's recorded response is,
"I have no idea."
Evan doesn't mention to Dave the scene described in his book about seeing Jackson with his hand on Jordan's crotch, supposedly from a month and a half ago. He's saying to Dave, "I have no idea if there's anything physical." So what is Evan so angry about? Here's more from Evan on the tape.
"And if I go through with this, I win big time. There's no way I lose. I've checked that inside and out. I will get everything I want, and they will be destroyed forever. June will lose Jordy, and Michael's career will be over."
Dave asks him,
"Does that help Jordy?"
And Evan answers,
"That's irrelevant to me."
It doesn't make sense that Evan is ready to destroy Jackson and get everything he wants if this is about molestation. Because according to Evan, he has no idea if there's any truth to that. Chandler's anger and vengefulness makes more sense when seen as a spiteful response to being repeatedly ignored by Jackson, and a response to having his dreams dashed of partnering with Jackson and his film company. You'll hear more later about Chandler's mental instability, but at this point, it sounds like Jackson picked the wrong guy to cut out of the picture. Evan continues telling Dave about this secret plan.
"It's already set. There are other people involved that are waiting for my phone call that are in certain positions. I've paid them to do it. Everything's going according to a certain plan that isn't just mine. Once I make that phone call, this guy is going to destroy everybody in sight in any devious, nasty, cruel way that he can do it."
Evan accuses Jackson of coming between this family of June, me, and Jordy. "That's the worst thing anybody could do to me. I see the emphasis is not on injury to Jordan, but injury to Evan." And the claim that Michael Jackson is breaking up their family is contradicted by June's testimony, that Evan neglected his son before Jackson came into their life. And once Evan gets divorced from his second wife, he completely neglects his other 2 children as well, confirmed by his brother Ray Chandler in their book. Evan continues from another part of the recording.
"I had a good communication with Michael. We were friends. I liked him and I respected him and everything else for what he is. There was no reason why he had to stop calling me."
Now this last sentence is a red flag for a repeated pattern I recognized in Jackson's accusers. In all 4 cases, there was anger and resentment that Jackson avoided them. In all 4 cases, there were aspirations to fame, such as Evan's screenwriting career. And in all 4 cases, there was an expectation that Jackson would do more for them. When Evan says, "There was no reason why he had to stop calling me," that's probably the biggest theme of this conversation. He was outraged that Jackson cut him off. Based on Evan's statements and based on the timing of when Jackson stopped talking to him, this appears to be the triggering event that set Evan off. Evan continues on to Dave.
"I sat in the room one day and talked to Michael, and told him exactly what I want out of this whole relationship. What I want.
From Evan's own words, it sounds like Jackson's version of events is more likely. That Evan asked Jackson for money for his movies and the house renovations, not that Jordan asked Michael, or that Michael said he'd pay. There's no mention in any part of this conversation about Michael Jackson offering to pay for anything. In a related part of the conversation, Evan recounts how he once told his wife that if she wanted to cheat on him, she better tell him first.
And you want to know what I told her? I told her this: if you ever want to sleep with somebody else, or if you don't love me anymore, if you come to me and you tell me that you want out of the house and his brains out, I'll love you forever. I'll support you and wish you well. But if it's the other way around, you him first, then you tell me, I'll kill you, period. Those are the rules. If you want to stay with me, you got to understand that's the only way I can survive. That's how I live. And so if I wasn't able to talk to her, this marriage would have been over a long time ago. Because of my imagination, Dave.
Evan then explains to Dave how he actually told Jackson his rules about always being able to talk to each other.
And one of the things I said is we always have to be able to talk to each other. That's the rule, okay? Because I know that as soon as you stop talking, weird things start going on, and imagination will just kill you.
So between the story of his wife and his telling Jackson his rules, Evan admits that when people stop talking to him, he has a tendency of imagining bad things about them. He also exposes his violent thoughts about what he will do to someone who he believes has wronged him. In the Chandler's book, Ray writes the following about his brother.
Once he locks his mind on something, nothing can dissuade him from attaining his goal. He becomes single-minded to the point of obsession.
This obsessiveness seen in Evan's behavior is another trait you will see repeatedly in the people most responsible for damaging Jackson's reputation. At a later point in the taped conversation, Evan is evasive about a secret plan against Jackson.
I don't mean to be devious. I just can't be specific about it. But I tell you that, again, it all comes down to one thing. They don't want to talk to me.
And continuing later, he says,
it's going to be bigger than all of us put together, and the whole thing is just going to crash down on everybody and destroy everybody in its sight. That's humiliating, believe me.
Dave asks,
and is that good?
And Evan responds,
yeah, it's great to get their attention.
Now I've included the most inflammatory parts of Evan's taped conversations. The actual recordings are much longer and include statements where Evan says removing Jackson is what's best for Jordan. But looking at Evan's actions, like putting his son in a room with someone he suspects of child molestation, does not convince me that he has Jordan's best interests at heart. By saying that he wants to get everything out in the public in his nasty way possible, Evan reveals the hypocrisy of his claims of wanting to protect Jordan. The overwhelming message I get from these recordings is that Evan is focused on himself, on getting what he wants. And he's furious that Jackson stopped calling him. His rantings have the appearance of a jealous and prideful rage at being left out. Another clear takeaway is hearing how Evan Chandler already has his whole secret plan to destroy Jackson plotted out before he ever gets a confession from Jordan. And it leaves me with the impression that Jordan's role for Evan is to simply fit into his plan.
Michael Jackson's lawyer, Burt Fields, is made aware of the situation after Evan's threatening phone call saying nothing could be more important than meeting with him on July 9th. Fields stops Jackson from going to this meeting and has a conference call with June and Dave, who both tell Fields that Evan just wants money.
Fields brings in investigator Anthony Pelicano, who worked for many lawyers in Hollywood and was known as being the best in the business at that time.
Pelicano will later be sentenced to 30 months on weapons charges in 2002 and given a 10-year sentence in 2008 for racketeering, wire fraud, and illegal wiretapping. In Ray and Evan's book, Evan suggests that Dave got the idea to tape their conversations from Pelicano, who may have even provided him with the equipment to do so. This seems like a reasonable argument to make, especially since Pelicano got caught later with illegal wiretapping. But whether or not Pelicano assisted in taping Evan's conversation, I don't find all that important when compared to the larger issue of what was said on the recordings, which is verified by Evan himself. Knowing Pellicano's shady history, however, I don't necessarily trust his words, but instead look at the circumstances around him to help judge the truthfulness of his account.
According to Pellicano's story in Mary Fisher's article, he listens to the recordings of Evan and Dave and immediately knows he's dealing with extortion. So that same day, July 9th, Pellicano says he meets with June, Jordan, and Jordan's younger sister, which is also confirmed in Evan's book. Pellicano says without Jackson there, he makes eye contact with Jordan and asks him very pointed questions, such as, "Has Michael ever touched you? Have you ever seen him naked in bed?" The answer to all the questions is no, and Jordan repeatedly denies any inappropriate behavior. Jordan tells Pellicano that his father was threatening Jackson for money.
Because of Pellicano's later convictions, I'm extra cautious in evaluating his words and actions. But I really have no reason to question that Jordan denies any molestation at this point. After all, he's also denying it to his father at this time. He continues to have his friendship with Jackson, planning to go on tour with him. And he reportedly says to a number of people he thought this was about money. It makes sense to me that if Pellicano suspected any molestation based on his questioning of Jordan, he would either have gone to police or recommended that Jackson settle things quietly, like Evan obviously wished. Pellicano would certainly have wanted to play nice with Evan if he suspected anything improper by Jackson. But Pellicano says he believes Jackson is innocent, that this is a baseless extortion attempt, and thinks they should absolutely not settle and take it to court if necessary.
Later that day, there was a fight at Evan's home between Dave Schwartz and Evan. Schwartz will later file an assault and battery suit against Evan, saying Evan repeatedly strikes him. Evan says it was not that bad and that Dave starts the aggression. Each has their own story as to who is the aggressor, but it's safe to say that tensions are very high on both sides.
2 days later, on July 11th, as confirmed by both sides, Jackson's lawyers convinced June Chandler to let Jordan stay with Evan for a week, with the assurance that he'll be returned after that week.
This advice by Jackson's lawyers is important. If Jackson is guilty, he and his lawyers should be doing everything in their power to keep Jordan, who's currently saying nothing happened, away from his suspicious dad. But no, they advised June to let Jordan go with his dad, hoping it would calm him down.
Once in his custody, Evan says the first thing he says to Jordan is,
"Don't even think about lying to me. This whole thing is about lying and nothing else. If someone lies to you, then you can't trust them. And if you can't trust them, there's no sense having a relationship. Just so you know, I had your bedroom at your mom's house bugged and your phone tapped. I know everything you and Michael did. This isn't about that. This is about lying. Do you understand?"
Here, Evan is letting Jordan know that the only truth he will accept is Jordan saying molestation occurred. There's no other answer that will be acceptable, because we know Evan has a preset plan for Jordan to make a confession. Notably, Evan is talking about how terrible lying is, yet he says in his book that he himself is lying about bugging Jordan's bedroom.
Evan says Jordan listens and nods, but doesn't show any fear or worry when Evan says he recorded them.
Jordan's response stood out to me here. Evan says he bugged the room and tapped the phone. If there is really molestation going on that Jordan doesn't want his dad to know about, it seems he might show fear or worry after that statement, or maybe start giving excuses.
Evan says over the next few days, he repeatedly tests Jordy, but nothing works, and Jordan reveals nothing that seems suspicious.
3 days after Jordan is with his dad on July 14th, Evan advances another step in his plan. He contacts a Beverly Hills psychiatrist and presents him with a hypothetical situation that Evan describes over the phone about a celebrity possibly molesting his son. The doctor sends a reply that states, "Reasonable suspicion would exist that abuse may have occurred." This is without meeting Jordan, who at that time denies abuse, but only through hearing Evan's version of hypothetical events.
Evan will later use this letter as part of his intimidation campaign to get what he wants from Jackson before taking these accusations public. Now, this psychiatrist also recommends that he see the victim immediately for evaluation, but Evan doesn't bring Jordan in. Evan says in his book that he doesn't want the publicity, but his own words in his taped recordings undermine that claim by saying his lawyer wanted to get this out in the public as fast as possible and that it was going to cause a massacre. So why wouldn't Evan bring his son in for treatment when told by a doctor that he should do so urgently. Meanwhile, Evan says he isn't getting anywhere with getting Jordan to tell the truth. But the only truth Evan is willing to accept is Jordan saying there was sexual contact with Jackson. And he makes this very clear to his son. Evan says he was just about to give up on all his plans, and then he gets the idea to check Jordan's teeth and pull a baby tooth. Evan says Jordan asks for anesthesia to knock him out. He says he and Jordan have this exchange about using anesthesia.
I can't. It's too dangerous.
Come on, you do it all the time.
Not on kids. It's a whole different thing.
How about Mark?
Referring to Evan's dental anesthesiologist.
Can't he do it?
So according to Evan, on July 16th, he pulls Jordan's tooth under sedation by his dental anesthesiologist, who then leaves after Jordan starts to wake up. It's at this point that Evan starts questioning Jordan, and the following quotes are from Evan's book.
Do you remember when you came over to the house? I told you that if you lied to me, I was going to destroy Michael. Keep that in mind. Do you care about Michael? You could say you love him, right? And you wouldn't want to hurt him?
Evan says he got no response. Even when he also added,
I bugged your room and know everything.
After 10 minutes with no truth revealed, Evan says he makes this threatening statement.
I'm going to give you one last chance to save Michael. If you lie to me, then I'm going to take him down in front of the whole world. It'll be all your fault because you're the one person who could have saved him. This isn't about me finding out. It's about lying. And you know what's going to happen if you lie. So I'm going to make it easy for you. I'm going to ask you one question. All you have to do is say yes or no. That's it. Lie and Michael goes down. Tell me the truth and you save him.
Evan says Jordan replies,
You won't hurt Michael? Promise you won't tell anyone?
I swear, no one.
Okay, what's the question?
Did Michael touch your privates?
Jordan hesitates, then quietly says yes. Evan says in his book that he heard all he needed to hear. He hugged Jordan and said they never talked about it again. The details didn't matter. This type of coercive questioning is familiar in known false confessions and reminds me of many well-known cases, such as the Central Park Five kids. These kids were held in custody with the understanding that the only way they could go home was to say, yes, I did it, even though it wasn't true.
The American Psychological Association recommends that when interviewing potential child victims of sexual abuse, you do not threaten them or ask leading questions, which they say can lead to false accusations.
Well, Evan not only is threatening that Jackson will be hurt if Jordan doesn't answer him the way he wants him to, he's adamant that the only acceptable truth is that he was molested. And he's been pushing this narrative constantly over the previous 6 weeks, but especially once Jordan's in his dad's custody. So Evan's tell me the truth is actually tell me what I want to hear and Jackson won't get hurt. Once Jordan makes this confession of saying yes, Evan doesn't ask for more details and doesn't take him to get psychological help. And instead of showing outrage or distress that his son just confessed to being molested, Evan seems elated in his own story, knowing that his plan can move forward and they go out to lunch and talk no more about it. Even if you ignore his role as a father, as a dentist, he's a mandated reporter. And his ethical lapses leave me with little trust in his version of events. Another issue with this confession is the controversy over the type of sedation used during the tooth extraction. I want to take some time to present this controversy because the reliability of Jordan's confession is key to the credibility of the Chandler case.
In her GQ article, Mary Fisher notes that on May 4, 1994, an LA newsman who turns out to be Harvey Levin, reports that Evan Chandler used sodium amytal on his son to pull his tooth. And while under the drug's influence, his son came out with the allegations. Fisher contacted Chandler's dental anesthesiologist and asked him about using sodium amytal on Jordan. She quotes him as saying, If I used it, it was for dental purposes.
J. Randy Taraborelli, in his Jackson biography, also stated that sodium amytal was used. Post-publication, Taraborelli revealed that he used Evan Chandler as a source for his book, although he doesn't say whether or not Evan specifically confirmed the use of sodium amytal.
In the 1990s, there was a surge of repressed memory sex abuse lawsuits, some of which involved sodium amytal, which was falsely thought at the time to be a truth serum. plaintiffs were trying to use sodium amytal to bolster their claims of abuse, saying that under the drug they recovered their repressed memories. The American Medical Association has stated that there is no evidence for the use of sodium amytal in recovered memory.
As early as 1952, studies revealed that sodium amytal, considered a hypnotic sedative, is not a true serum, but can actually induce false memories.
Mary Fisher quotes Cleveland psychiatrist Philip Resnick about the use of sodium amytal.
People are very suggestible under it. It is quite possible to implant an idea through the mere asking of a question. The idea can become their memory, and studies have shown that even when you tell them the truth, they will swear on a stack of Bibles that it happened.
Fisher also quotes Dr. John Jagiela from UCLA's School of Dentistry.
It's unusual for it to be used for pulling a tooth. It makes no sense when better, safer alternatives are available. It would not be my choice.
So did Evan Chandler use sodium amytal to get his confession? The evidence isn't clear. It's notable that Evan in his book is very specific about the drug name and dosage he used on Michael Jackson for his headache, Toradol 30 milligrams, but he doesn't identify the sedation drug he uses for his son. This may be because Rayon Evans' book isn't published until 2004. They started work on their book in 1993 and were feeding stories from the book to the media back then. But they didn't publish until the second sex abuse case gave them an opportunity in 2004. By this time, sodium amytal has been scientifically debunked as a truth serum, so it makes sense that Chandler wouldn't include the name of this drug in a book published in 2004. So it's left as a very odd story. Evan says he gets this idea to pull Jordan's tooth as a way to extract a confession. But he leaves out the name of this so-called dangerous agent he uses to knock Jordan out. In the coercive language Evan said he used to get the confession is troubling. He has a plan he wants to carry out step by step, and part of that plan was to get a confession from Jordan. His brother describes Evan's obsessive nature, and Evan himself says how he hammered his son with lectures about how he knew Jordan was lying and that he bugged his room. He said how Jackson would be hurt if Jordan didn't tell the truth. And he didn't want Jackson to be hurt, did he?
There are some that have argued that this confession may not have happened at all, but was a concocted event that Evan added to hype up his story. But even if Evan made up the sodium amytal story, you don't need an anesthetic to come up with false memories of abuse. And the McMartin preschool trial is a perfect example of that. Under repeated, coercive, and sometimes antagonistic questioning, hundreds of kids came up with abuse stories that were deemed false without being under the influence of any drug.
Or Jordan's confession may not be a case of false memory. It's possible that Evan convinced Jordan that Jackson abused other boys and would abuse him later. He could have convinced Jordan that Jackson needed to pay, which justified the false allegations. We know from psychology research that children are highly susceptible to their parents' influence. And parents who lie lower the barriers for their own children to lie. Even a prosecution expert witness in Jackson's 2005 trial confirmed this. Kids model their parents' behavior. We also know that emotions are very contagious. Evan's anger and sense of entitlement to Jackson's money could have been contagiously passed on to Jordan, even if no actual abuse had occurred. Unless Jordan Chandler comes forward and explains it himself, we can only guess at why and under exactly what circumstances he makes this confession. Was Jordan trying to protect Jackson? Did he imagine the abuse under his dad's pressure? Did he feel entitled to Jackson's money like his father? We can speculate, but in the bigger picture, I found it wasn't critical information. Because no matter how you look at it, it's bad for the Chandlers. If the tooth pulling under sedation did happen, it's an unquestionably unreliable confession. If it didn't happen, then Evan was lying about it in his book, suggesting that what really happened was even more underhanded. But whether or not his tooth-pulling story is true, Evan reveals a suspicious lack of transparency, and his coercive methods of extracting the confession should be factored against its credibility.
For additional evidence on this confession, you can visit the episode notes section on our website.
On July 17th, a day after the alleged confession, Evan uses the hypothetical case of abuse to try and pressure June into signing the new custody agreement so he can get Jordan. but she still doesn't sign.
Over the next few weeks, Evan continues to try and pressure June into transferring custody. But why is Evan using a hypothetical case of abuse instead of bringing up what would be most convincing, Jordan's own confession?
A couple weeks later, on August 1st, Evan says in his book that if he can just get Jackson in a meeting by himself, they could work out a solution.
It appears that Evan is holding Jordan's confession in his back pocket, to use only as a last resort if he doesn't get what he wants, which is money from Jackson in custody of Jordan. Jordan's confession is clearly the massacre situation he said would happen if he didn't get what he wants. But Evan thinks he can get what he wants if he can just get Jackson to negotiate with him.
Evan finally gets his meeting 3 days later, on August 4th. Jackson brings Pelicano and Evan brings Jordan.
We have two different accounts of this meeting. Because of what's come to light about both Pelicano and Evan, I don't trust either side, but I focus instead on where the accounts agree and how they fit into the larger picture. Both Evan and Pelicano say Evan gave Jackson a big hug at the beginning of the meeting, which is odd after all the threats and all the anger he's expressed towards Jackson. Here it is in Ray Chandler's book.
Evan then walked over to Michael and embraced the star with a big, happy-to-see-you hug, patting him on the back like an old friend.
To me, it's an indication of what Evan's anger was really about, Jackson not giving him attention. But when he's finally in front of Jackson, getting the attention he wants, the anger is gone, and he's friendly. If he was really angry about what his son allegedly already confessed to, the opening hug is a bizarre way to start the meeting.
Evan says that Pelicano had indicated before the meeting that he had a plan to help Evan and Jordan reestablish their relationship with money to start a filmmaking career together.
But Evan says now at their meeting, Pelicano denies that he made any such implication of filmmaking starter money. Evan's happiness then turns into rage. He makes threats about sex abuse accusations and then storms off, with Jordan mute throughout. My main takeaway from this meeting is that Evan comes into it thinking he's being offered some money and is angry when that doesn't happen. That Jackson and Pelicano allow him to walk away angrily without any offer or attempt to appease him, is more suggestive of an innocent man trying to catch his accuser in an extortion attempt than it is of a guilty man trying to save himself from being exposed.
Later that same day, on August 4th, Chandler and his lawyer Rothman meet with Pelicano to demand $20 million. Evan says his lawyer tries to talk him down to $5 million, but he's fixed on $20 million. It's notable that Evan is stuck on this $20 million, which is half the Sony money Evan was asking for back in May, according to Jackson's associates.
Evan says the money is to punish Jackson, not an extortion. But whether you call it extortion or punishment, the negotiation here is clearly about paying money so that Evan doesn't go forward with this hypothetical claim of abuse. There's still no mention to Pelicano or anyone of Jordan's actual confession. Pelicano doesn't negotiate or offer anything at this meeting.
According to the Chandler's book, 3 days later, on August 9th, Pelicano comes back with a counteroffer of $1 million to fund three screenplays written by Evan and Jordan. Since Evan asked for $20 million, he's offended and angry at this insulting offer and believes Pelicano is not taking him seriously. Pelicano later says he made this lowball counteroffer to be able to record Chandler and his lawyer negotiating for money, which he does. Evan turns down the $1 million, expecting a bigger offer.
On August 11th, Evan says he convinces Jordan to confess to June, and he does, with Evan right by his side. June says she wants to see Jordan away from Evan, but he refuses to let Jordan out of his sight. He says June and Dave are convinced that Evan brainwashed him.
Evan's behavior of not allowing Jordan's own mother to ask her son questions, or to see him without Evan present, is indicative of his wanting absolute control of the situation.
2 days later, on August 13th, Pelicano's next offer, which he also says was to record them negotiating about money, shocks Evan and his lawyer. Pelicano actually went down in his offer from $1 million, which Chandler turned down, to $350,000. Evan says Rothman turns down this offer, but says to Pelicano that Evan might be willing to take the original $1 million offer if Pelicano was willing to renew it. Evan quotes Pelicano's response as, "It's never going to happen."
So Jackson, according to Evan's own story and through Pelicano's actions and words, demonstrates that he was never serious about negotiating. And this is what Evan's book has to say about Jackson's unwillingness to negotiate.
Had Michael paid the $20 million demanded of him in August, rather than the following January, he might have spent the next 10 years as the world's most famous entertainer, instead of the world's most infamous child molester.
I find this statement remarkable in its naked admission that the Chandlers have no interest in pursuing justice against Michael Jackson. This statement also implies that if Michael Jackson had paid Evan $20 million in August, his son would never have gotten therapy. A therapist would have had to report molestation and a criminal investigation would have ensued. So Evan would keep his son from getting treatment just so he can get this money? Is Evan simply that narcissistic, or is he also not convinced that Jackson molested his son? Pelicano's refusal to honestly engage in these negotiations to me indicates that Jackson was trying to catch Evan Chandler negotiating for money. If Jackson was really guilty, you should have instead seen an effort to lessen tensions, trying to work things out, and not inflaming the situation by making insulting offers.
Geraldine Hughes is the legal secretary for Evan's lawyer, Barry Rothman, at the time of the allegations. Hughes publishes a book in 2004 called Redemption about her observations of what was going on in Rothman's office with Evan and Jordan.
Hughes notes in her book that when Evan didn't return Jordan after a week as promised, June Chandler files an emergency custody hearing on August 16th. Hughes says the damaging information against Evan is that they went to court in front of a judge on the issue of custody, and Evan never mentions child molestation concerns. This is 1 month after Jordan's alleged confession in the dentist chair. Meanwhile, they have been negotiating with Jackson for the past month, trying to get money by using a hypothetical case of molestation as leverage. Because Evan didn't bring up any concerns at this custody hearing, the judge orders he return Jordan back to his mom.
After the hearing, Evan goes into action and calls Mathis Abrams, the psychiatrist who'd given the hypothetical abuse statement. Evan says in his book that because he was being forced to return Jordan to June, he only had one move left in his plan, and this was it.
The following morning, August 17th, Jordan tells the psychiatrist that Jackson molested him. Oral sex, kissing, but no penetration, which would require a medical exam for verification. Dr. Abrams then reports the accusation, which launches the criminal investigation against Jackson. As a result of the allegations, Evan does not have to return Jordan to his ex-wife.
Dr. Abrams later says in an interview with CBS that he wasn't given the opportunity to try to find out about whether or not there was coaching. Once he reported the accusation to authorities, his role was over.
Rothman's legal secretary, Geraldine Hughes, claims that before Evan took his son to Dr. Abrams to confess, Jordan spent hours in Rothman's office, alone with the attorney, behind closed doors.
I really believe that the whole thing was plotted and planned, and the words were given to Jordan Chandler to say, because I witnessed the 13-year-old in my attorney's office without any supervision of his parents, and he was kind of snuck in there. It was like no one in the office knew he was in there.
If true, this is undoubtedly suspicious. Jordan is not sent to get help after his alleged confession to Evan, but is sent instead to a lawyer's office for hours at a time. A lawyer who Evan himself describes as nasty, cruel, and devious, and seeking maximum publicity. We heard how this lawyer gave Evan step-by-step plans that he was to follow to the letter. If this is a false accusation, and if Jordan did spend hours in Rothman's office, it makes sense that Jordan is also getting his plan, and being coached for what to say and what not to say. June Chandler meets with police on August 19th, who tell her that Jackson fits the profile of a pedophile. And even though she previously told police that she thought Evan brainwashed Jordan, she now switches sides and joins Evan's lawsuit. Mary Fisher, who uses June Chandler's lawyer as a source, says that June was afraid of Evan filing a lawsuit against her for negligence. Fisher also notes that after June switches sides, her own attorney, Michael Freeman, resigns in disgust. He later says,
"The whole thing was such a mess. I felt uncomfortable with Evan. He isn't a genuine person, and I sensed he wasn't playing things straight."
4 days later, on August 23rd, the day before Jackson's first performance in Asia on the final leg of the Dangerous Tour, more than 60 agents execute a surprise raid on Neverland Ranch. The police raid on Neverland is where we'll end our story today.
Next time, in part two of the Chandler case, you'll hear about the media frenzy after the accusation becomes public. And we'll introduce the journalist Jackson's supporters describe as the puppeteer of the allegations.
We'll cover the steps that led to Jackson's settlement with the Chandlers and discuss DA Tom Snedden's single-minded pursuit of the criminal case against Jackson.
We'd like to thank the following websites for collecting and analyzing the evidence for the Chandler case over many years. The Michael Jackson Allegations, Turning the Tables on the Chandlers and Vindicating Michael.
These sites, which help guide my mom's research and all sources for this episode, can be found on our website, MichaelJacksonCaseForInnocence.com. You can reach out to us through our website or find us on Twitter at @Case4Innocence. Thank you for listening to the Michael Jackson Case for Innocence podcast.